their favorite EU commissioner. In November, he was given an award by the European Jewish Association, a leading pro-Israel group. Over the past few months, he has held talks with a number of pro-Israel lobbyists. The scant details for those talks made available by the European Commission indicate that they were focused on how anti-Semitism should be fought. It is more likely that he is assisting the Zionist regime with its cynical and grotesque efforts to make Jewish trauma a kagel for beating Palestinians and allies of their struggle. Varhaley has also welcomed the return of Benjamin Netanyahu as the Zionist regime's prime minister. Netanyahu heads the most overtly racist regime since the Zionist regime's inception. The firebrands now sitting as ministers surely regard Varhaley as their number one body in Brussels. Meanwhile, according to Press TV, Secretary General of the United Nations Antonio Guterres says Palestinians are suffering and living in hell under the prolonged occupation of the Zionist regime as tensions are high in the occupied West Bank after Israeli settlers set dozens of Palestinian homes and cars on fire in what happened to be the worst outburst of settler violence in decades. Guterres said in an interview with Qatar-based Al Jazeera television news network that he was following with great concern the situation in the town of Hawara, where a Palestinian aid worker was killed, hundreds of others wounded, and dozens of homes and cars were torched during the last week's rampage by Jewish extremists. He stressed that the Palestinian people are suffering a lot at present and that life in the Israeli besieged Gaza Strip in many aspects is a life of hell.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Italy is seriously mulling over resorting to developing its nuclear energy in this crucial geopolitical conjuncture. On Monday, three Italian energy firms, Ansaldo Energia, Ansaldo Nucleare and Edison Spa, announced that they have signed a letter of intent with major French utility Électricité de France, also known as EDF. The deal features collaboration on the development of new nuclear projects in Europe and, quote, to open a debate on the possible role of new nuclear power in Italy's energy transition.
L'obiettivo dichiarato da Edison è quello.
Italy's Edison Energy Company says it wants to produce its own nuclear energy starting from between 2030 and 2035. This would be obtained thanks to provisions which have introduced considerable simplifications of the procedures to build smaller and safer nuclear plants. However, the risk is that the projects may encounter strong opposition by local governments.
Italy closed its nuclear plants in 1990 after a referendum on atomic energy held 3 years earlier, following a new referendum held in 2011 when 94% of Italians voted again against the atomic option. The idea of a return to nuclear power seemed dead and buried. However, the energy crisis triggered by the war in Ukraine seems to have changed people's mind in Italy, according to latest surveys. While only 15% of Italians are fully supportive of nuclear energy, one in two Italians believe that switching back to nuclear energy could be a solution to the issue of high energy bills if safer and cleaner nuclear technology is employed.
Riguardo al nucleare, io sono favorevole.
I am in favor of the nuclear option because we are already buying nuclear-produced energy from France and Spain. And if there is an accident at the plants over there, we would also suffer from the consequences.
Magari potrebbe essere una scelta europea.
Nuclear energy is produced by several European countries these days. Why not in Italy? Maybe this decision should be adopted at a European level.
The issue of nuclear energy came up again in Italy in 2021, particularly following the former Mario Draghi's government expressing support for the return to nuclear power in the country. This was then followed by a consensual agreement voiced by the current Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni. Max Civili, Rome.
Supporters of the People's Democratic Party, PDP, marched through the streets of Abuja, chanting and condemning the results of the just-concluded presidential election in Nigeria.
Why did you go by 4 a.m. to announce the result? What was the hurry if you have the seven days window? And then the chairman said that I will listen to all the petitions before we conclude this process. He went ahead and concluded the process and did not open a window for the review of those issues.
The demonstrators say the Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, did not follow some provisions of the electoral laws in conducting the election and in announcing the results.
800.
The demonstrators marched to the headquarters of the INEC in Abuja, where they demanded unsuccessfully to see the chairman of Nigeria's electoral body. The opposition PDP and the Labour Party have separately approached the Court of Appeal, challenging the outcome of the February 25 presidential election. The Court of Appeal, which serves as a presidential election petition court, has granted the request of the two political parties for access to inspect sensitive election materials. The demonstrators here said the protest is necessary in view of the gubernatorial and state houses of assembly elections coming up on 11th of March.
What we are here to do first is that the issue of their infractions in the last elections will be dealt with by the court. But going forward, how are we going to resolve this for the elections we have on the 11th of March? That is the most important question on the minds of Nigerians today.
Meanwhile, Nigeria's president-elect Bola Ahmed Tinubu has appealed to the opposition to come and join him to work for the unity and progress of Nigeria. Nigeria's president-elect is expected to be sworn in May 29, 2023, once the courts have established him as the winner of the elections. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
It's another ordinary day for Shivina Khan and her family living in the eastern part of New Delhi. The family starts their day by reading their father's letters, which he wrote in jail, pleading his innocence regarding the riots that broke out in Delhi back in February 2020. The violence claimed dozens of lives, shattered many families and destroyed their property, claimed 53 lives, mostly of Muslims.
My husband was going to work, but on the way, riots sparked and he called me saying the situation is bad, please be safe. In another 30 minutes, he said the riots had started even near his office. He was questioned for several days before being arrested for crime he never committed. I have three children and it's really hard for us to cope up with situations.
Another activist and mother of jailed student Umar Khalid says Muslims are now treated like terrorists in their own country. She said all the charges against his son are politically motivated and a deliberate attempt to demonize Muslims. She says the so-called Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, which is a draconian legislation amended in 2019 by the ruling BJP, allows authorities to declare an individual a terrorist and keep them in detention without trial for months or even years.
It's been 2.5 years since my son is in jail. He was arrested on September 2020 and the charges framed against him are completely false and baseless. He was arrested in connection with the Delhi riots in 2022 and the two FIRs have been registered. One of the charges is UAPA and it's not easy to get bail if such a charge is framed. Media these days is supporting false propaganda, but we have complete faith in our judiciary and we will fight for his release from the Supreme Court.
Umar and Salim are not just only victims languishing in jails without trials. Activists and critics accuse the authorities of accusing Muslim community members of a crime they did not commit. Based on reports by Human Rights Watch, police investigation in the cases were marked by bias, delays, inaccuracy, lack of proper evidence, and a failure to follow proper procedures. Reports suggest that the Indian government has in recent years adopted various laws and policies that are discriminatory towards the country's minorities. The ruling party is also accused of infiltrating country's courts and police, empowering Hindu nationalists to harass, threaten and attack religious minorities with impunity, and cracking down on any dissent. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Iranians have observed the National Tree Planting Day as part of the Natural Resources Week by planting saplings across the country. The country has now launched a wider campaign to plant 1 billion trees in 4 years. Accordingly, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, marked the National Tree Planting Day by planting 3 saplings. Meanwhile, President Ebrahim Raisi went to the National Botanical Garden of Iran in Tehran to mark the event and start a campaign to plant 1 billion trees nationwide. The Natural Resources Week represents more than just planting trees. It's a strong message of protecting the environment and changing attitudes and lifestyles. Each tree means a gift from the current generation to posterity to have a green and healthy planet. National Tree Planting Day is annually celebrated on the 15th day of Isfand, the last month on the Iranian calendar. The day also marks the beginning of the National Week of Natural Resources.
Iranians have always paid special attention to nature. They believe planting saplings will make the world a better place to live for us, our children, and the generations to come. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran-Afghanistan Permanent Trade Center has been opened in the capital, Kabul. The center is in line with the two countries' policies of expanding bilateral ties and connecting business people of the two neighboring states. During the opening ceremony, Afghanistan's Minister of Industry and Commerce highlighted the country's expectations about trade between the two countries.
We expect to balance the trade with Iran. We want to export our goods to Iran, which enjoys a good market. Iran's export to Afghanistan is more than $2 billion a year, but I won't mention our export to Iran because it's a very small amount. We hope that Tehran modifies its laws so that we can increase our exports.
With the opening of this center in Kabul and its capabilities, it is believed that the Taliban government in Afghanistan is providing a platform for more economic connections between Tehran and Kabul.
This center is an example of good relations between Afghanistan and Iran. Both countries have a lot of potentials, and with the opening of this center, we hope that bilateral trade gets a big boost and Tehran and Kabul can be great partners.
The center has great capabilities which can have great effects on rebuilding Afghanistan and the war-torn country's infrastructure.
The priorities for this center are trade of industries, equipment and machineries, also food industry, mining industry and technology. We are also ready to set up an iron production line in Afghanistan. On the other side, mines and precious stones here are useful for Iran.
Iranian and Afghan officials hope that the center helps advance the export goals of the two countries. They highlighted that the development of sustainable trade and exports is the most important task of this center in Kabul.
Many believe the opening of such trade centers would have positive effects on Afghanistan's economy that has taken a lot of damage due to years of political and financial instability. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Even though inflation remains at a 40-year high, United States President Joe Biden has terminated a program which provided extra food money for over 40 million of the poorest Americans. The elderly, the disabled, students, poor children, and the working poor are now forced to find an average of nearly $100 more every month to spend on food. With sanctions on Russia still massively backfiring across the West, grocery prices here have soared more than 11% over the last year.
The families aren't purchasing food at the same price that they were pre-pandemic. So if not, you know, apart from having families come in more often, we may start seeing families that have to cut back on their housing budget. So what they typically spent on rent, utilities, they may have to start dipping into that to pay for groceries.
Experts on food insecurity contend that food aid to the poor has been insufficient, and that was long before the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program started seeing cuts. The expansion of so-called food stamps was both popular and successful, leading to an immediate 10% reduction in the overall poverty rate and a 14% drop in child poverty.
Versus 2021, when a lot of the pandemic relief was in force, our numbers were actually down significantly. So we've seen our numbers grow from 2021 to 2022 about 40%. Give or take, we can only imagine what this next round will bring.
Without government involvement, citizens can only turn to charities for help. In states which have prematurely stopped the expanded food aid, food banks are already reporting a 40% increase in the number of visitors. Last year, the ruling Democrats voted to end the pandemic's expansion of Medicaid, the federal program which provides a bare minimum of health care for the nation's poor. At the end of this month, at least 15 million people will also lose their health care coverage. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
By some accounts, the history of animation stretches back to the turn of the 20th century. However, the art finds its roots in antiquity. A 5,200-year-old vase found in Iran's burnt city in the 1970s features a series of five images that researchers have only recently identified as being sequential. Giving it a spin, one would see a goat leaping to snatch leaves from a tree. Fast forward to today, Iranian animations have made significant progress. While the first modern cinematic animations were produced in Iran about a decade ago, thanks to the efforts by Iran's talented youths, the country's animated movies have attracted the attention of a huge number of viewers. The number of high-quality animations has grown compared to previous years in Iran. The new award-winning animated blockbuster Lupetu is a perfect example. The name Lupetu is inspired by a word local people in Kerman province of Iran used to refer to handmade toys that mothers used to make for their children in the past. The animation is about a sanitarium where a doctor treats his mental patients by teaching them to make toys. An unknown culprit vandalizes the creative toy workshop, which is particularly popular among Iranian children, and causes its closure. The doctor's son, Ali, tries to help his father to solve the problem. The process of making the animation took over 3 years. It was ready to be screened in 2020. However, the coronavirus outbreak delayed the screening, and finally, it hit Iran's silver screens from early November 2022. The box office hit is one of the most popular on-screen films of Iranian cinemas right now. It managed to become the most popular movie in Iranian cinemas only within a month and a half of its release in the fall season. Lupetu has also taken part in various national and international festivals. Despite their success, the director of Lupetu says there is no room for complacency, adding, Iranian animation studios should redouble their efforts to keep up with the big names in the industry.
Iran's animation industry is progressing. It's perfect that children can watch this animation in the cinemas. But we have a long way to go. We should produce more high-quality cinematic animations to keep up with foreign animations.
Lupetu's producers say it will soon be screened in other countries, with Turkey and Russia showing interest to screen the animation in their cinemas.
Several high-quality cinematic animations have been made in Iran in recent years, and Lupetu is one of them.
The blockbuster animation's success testifies that Iran has made significant progress that puts it on a par with big names in the industry.
In order to avoid paying billions of dollars in fines, it appears that the Pakistani government is attempting to find a solution for the completion of an Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project. This comes after Pakistani lawmakers demanded progress on the publicly funded project and warned that Pakistan could face its penalty if the pipeline project with Iran is not completed before the year end. The Petroleum Ministry officials warn that Pakistan will have to pay $18 billion as a fine if it terminates Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline agreement. The officials told lawmakers that Islamabad has spoken to the United States to request a waiver as there is a ban on importing gas from Iran. The parliamentarians asked the Pakistani Ministry of Foreign Affairs to summon the American envoy and demand that he either grant Islamabad permission to move forward with the project or provide funding to cover the fine. Washington has been pushing Islamabad to give up the plan to import gas from neighboring Iran. However, the government has so far publicly resisted the pressure, arguing that the project is vital to fulfill the country's energy needs.
We should revive the Iran-Pakistan pipeline. That is the key. And we also demand the lifting of sanctions which have been imposed by certain Western countries against Iran, because the sanctions are wrong, they are unjust, and they are immoral. And Iran, like Pakistan, is a peaceful country. They want to strengthen regional relations.
Like the rest of the world, Pakistan is no exception to the global energy crisis, which is worsening each passing day. Experts believe that pending gas pipeline project with Iran could be an immediate remedy to overcome the energy needs in Pakistan if the country manages to get out of the U.S. influence.
Because of the U.S. Importance in foreign relations, Pakistan has always been pressurized by the United States not to increase its trade with Iran and not to negotiate any agreements with Iran. Unfortunately, Pakistan has yielded to that pressure. Pakistan is importing gas from Qatar and other countries, Azerbaijan even, and why not import gas from Iran, which is cheaper than from so many other countries.
In 2009, the gas companies of both Pakistan and Iran signed an agreement under which Islamabad committed to building an 800-kilometer pipeline to the Iranian border by the end of 2014. However, due to the U.S. pressure, Islamabad could not fulfill its commitment. Iran has already finished a portion of the pipeline in its own territory from the gas field to the Pakistan border, where it should connect to the Pakistani part.
The call on the Pakistani government to step up efforts to complete Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project comes as Islamabad is already grappling with several crises here at home. Avoiding this $18 billion penalty could save the country from falling into another one. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Mahdi, the savior of humankind, April 9th, 2020. Imam Mahdi's reappearance is the start of humankind's growth. Everyone, including the elites, those who can understand events, and the masses of people throughout the world in various countries, who may be preoccupied with their daily life and unaware of developments, feel this need, either consciously or unconsciously. Of course, all religions have promised this. In all religions, there is a promise of relief and a great divine movement at the end of history, which is, of course, not the end of history. The real world and humanity's real life will start from when the Imam of the time comes. So for the end of the situation that now exists in life, all religions have promised such a future. When they reach the main road, they will not stop moving ahead. No, they will start their movement toward lofty divine goals, because human beings enjoy an inexhaustible capacity. Throughout these long centuries, humanity has moved along deviated paths, the wrong paths and difficult paths, and it has faced various obstacles. With a pained, wounded, injured body, it has moved along these paths in order to reach this main road. This main road is the road of the time of their appearance. It is the world that will be built after their appearance. In a sense, humanity's movement will start from that point.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Believing in Imam of the time, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, helps people to not succumb to evil, provided that they fully comprehend this belief. When this belief is truly placed in hearts, its presence is felt among the people. The sacred, beloved, infallible Imam, the hub of the universe, the refuge of all creation, is present even though he is in occultation and has not reappeared. How is it possible to think he is not present? The devout believers feel his presence in their hearts and with all their emotions and senses. Those individuals who pray and supplicate God, read the Nutbah supplication with due attention, and recite Ziyarat Ali Yasin while understanding what they are reciting, they feel the presence of this great person, even if he has not yet reappeared. His absence does not affect this feeling that he is present. He has not reappeared, but he is present in the hearts and is among the people. How is it possible to believe he is not present? A true Shia is someone who feels the Imam's presence and feels that he is before him. This gives vitality and enthusiasm to a person. This great nation needs this hope more than anything else. The nation which fights on the path of God and for the sake of greatness of Islam has become an honor for all of human history and for all of the history of Islam. In our time, it has raised the flag of Islam. Such a nation needs this bright hope more than anything else. This belief brings this hope for them.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you.
Monlay.
Doing us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The Islamic Republic has been pursuing the policy of expanding relations with a look towards the East in particular, while also aiming to grow trade ties with Africa and Latin America. In tonight's program, we'll discuss the extent to which Iran has been successful in this regard with our guests. Academic and political analyst Bruno Beclini joining us from Porto Alegre, Brazil. We also have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joining us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Start off with Mr. Beclini in Porto Alegre. It's great to have you with us, both of you gentlemen. Mr. Beclini, Iran and Venezuela have launched their first direct shipping line as the two countries work to step up cooperation in different fields. How do you view the significance of such a step?
Well, first of all, it will be a reference for the whole maritime freight and commerce between Latin America and the Islamic Republic. Because it's very difficult, for example, for Brazilian exporters to get maritime freight to Iran. And also, the majority of the major of the bulks and the vessels of the merchant fleet from Iran is more dedicated to the Asian continent. So it's a great notice. Also, it includes a question of security, maritime security, considering that the Atlantic and the South Atlantic, it is the majority of the Navy operating there is Anglo-Saxon, being U.S. or Great Britain Navy. They surrounded the Atlantic Southern Ocean from Latin America to Africa, and this is a great notice, even more because, as far as I know, these bulks will also go through South Africa, increasing the commerce between other BRICS countries, like South Africa.
John Bozich, the shipping line has been launched as Iran and Venezuela pledge to boost bilateral ties in various fields. They just signed a 20-year strategic agreement to expand cooperation on energy and agriculture, among other things. Now, both countries, as we know, are under U.S. sanctions and have been looking for alternatives to neutralize that pressure. It looks like the more the U.S. tries to crank up the pressure, the target countries, they manage to come up with more opportunities.
Well, actually, that's the case. During the 1990s, when the United States put sanctions here on Serbia, Serbia developed entire new industries and autonomous production inside the country, eliminating the need for many Western imports. The same thing, of course, has happened with Cuba, and we now hear that Russia is a net agricultural exporter after many decades of having to import agricultural products. So what we're seeing is not just isolated results that are successful, but a blanket response of productivity, autonomy, and independence economically as a result of American sanctions. There is nothing other to say except that these sanctions have backfired and they have united the world against the United States.
Mr. Buclini, the Iranian embassy in Venezuela says that one ship will be sent to Venezuela every 3 months. What kind of a response are you expecting to see from the U.S. in this regard? If you recall, back in 2020, when Iran sent oil tankers to Venezuela, Washington had threatened to prevent Venezuela from receiving the ships from Iran. Now, much to the dissatisfaction of the U.S., those ships were received by Venezuela. What about now?
Everything is possible when we think about the so-called hawks living in Washington, D.C. Their capabilities are very, very wide one, and their morality allows them to do everything. Anything is possible and it's unpredictable. But as far as I believe in Latin America capacity of self-defense and autonomous diplomacy, I don't think that Biden administration would dare to do this regarding what is happening now in Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Chile, Bolivia. We are much more self-determined than we would be 5 years ago or even 3 years ago. It will be a hardcore situation for them, allowing the sovereign command, the military combatant commando permanent that they put to project power against us in Latin America, to frighten and to do this, I would say, piracy against Iranian vessels. I don't think they will dare like this, but considering U.S. policies, everything is possible.
Mr. Bosnich, let's look at this in the bigger picture. The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, had promised a more comprehensive, quote-unquote, look to the east. Iran seems to be moving in that very direction. Now, a 25-year strategic agreement was recently signed between Tehran and China. What would a boost in economic, energy, and trade relations between Tehran and Beijing mean?
Obviously, this is going to lead to a greater level of integration in other areas other than just energy. China has a great number of technologies and productive capacities that will be of interest and of great use to Iran. Iran also has its excellent drone technologies and military defense technologies that it is certainly more than willing to share with countries facing similar pressure from the United States. I'd also like to predict right now that the one boat every 3 months is going to become one boat every month with Venezuela. And after the first 2 months, it's going to become one boat every week, because the natural flow of trade between countries under sanctions can only explode exponentially. Because these countries have the right to trade, they have the right under the World Trade Organization to trade, and the United States cannot legally sanction or block trade between two independent countries on the open seas.
Mr. Bosnich, I'm going to stay with you. You mentioned the issue of integration. Iran, as we also know, was recently granted full membership at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO. How significant is SCO membership of Iran? What are the implications for Iran across the board economically and diplomatically? And what does it mean for Iran to be an SCO member? How can a stronger, what can a stronger SCO do in particular for the region?
Well, let's compare the, let's say, rival economic groupings around the world. We've got the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is basically a resource rape by the United States from Mexico and Canada. Being a Canadian, I know that firsthand. In the EU, we have former colonial powers trying to make a go of it without the resources that they need locally. And they're doing very, very poorly, as we see with the energy crisis and the insanity of blowing up their own fuel lines in cooperation with the United States. So there's no doubt that the SCO is about to become, if not already, the world's single largest and most important economic cooperation organization. And with the increase of economic cooperation, we're going to see cultural, political, and military cooperation to protect their domestic territory and their rights. I'm looking at the SCO as being the major element in the pendulum shift on this planet toward the east.
Mr. Baklini, Iran says that it's expanding relations with the look towards the east in particular, while also eyeing growing trade ties with Africa and with Latin America. How important can these expansions be?
It's a huge importance because for us, for example, in Brazil, Iran is a middle power, ranked in the same level as Brazil, a little bit more in high tech, a little bit less in agriculture, for example. And we can expect for another situation. So Iran expanding commerce, trade, and also a kind of soft power on our societies, it will embrace a part, a portion of the elite in Latin America who has Arab descendancy. I insist on this. Only in Brazil, we are 16 million Arab descendants. We have the vice president. We have the Minister of Economy. We have the Minister of Planning. It's not a small thing to deal with. So Iran working in trade in Africa and Latin America can embrace a part of the ruling class of those countries to look to the east as a solution to get rid of the U.S. dollar as the international currency and the threats of the sanctions coming from Washington, for example.
And the same question that we had for Mr. Bozich, I'm going to bring it to you, Mr. Baklini, as well. How do you perceive the functionality of an organization like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, with Iran as a member?
It's wonderful. It's a huge challenge because the SCO and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it can establish a new pattern of international trade. For example, putting in concrete the dream of Lord Keynes of having the Bancor, an international currency, without being connected to a central bank like it was, first of all, in England during the 19th century, and then with the U.S. Federal Bank Service, the Fed. So the SCO can expand the trade between Asia and from Asia to Africa and to Latin America. The most important thing that we must understand in international trade, international system, is that we cannot allow anymore the U.S. to be the police of the world. We cannot allow anymore them to say which country will be inside the SWIFT system and which country will without SWIFT system. We must expand the systems, the banking system, to get rid of U.S. dollar as international currency and to get rid of the SWIFT system. That's a must-be situation.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
John Bozich, these advancements now at the time of the toughest sanctions ever on Iran have led to Iran becoming more and more self-sufficient. Has the maximum pressure campaign and sanctions regime not been successful?
Well, I mean, unless Iran has its man in Washington who's organizing these sanctions to help Iran become independent, no. The United States is behaving like a bully. And that's what they are. They pretend to be the global policeman, but actually what they are is the global bully. And we know, all of us, from our primary school days in school, that there is usually a bully. And the bully uses his brute force against several weaker people that he finds in his class until He runs into one who is not going to be pushed around. The Americans have run into Russia, they have run into China, and they have now run into Iran. And they are not going to be able to push around neither Russia nor China nor Iran. And this is the way the bully is brought into line. And if necessary, this is the way that the bully is brought down.
Mr. Beklini, Tehran, first of all, the issue bringing countries together, which was mentioned by Mr. Bozich, the Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, has stressed that his country's foreign policy, meaning Iran, is based on opposition to unilateralism. Now, what countries like Iran, Russia, China, Venezuela, and a number of other countries they surely have in common is opposition to unilateralism. So are the U.S. sanctions and Washington's enmity actually binding more countries together?
No, of course not. They're trying to subordinate the European Union, and they have succeeded in it, promoting and escalating the war in Ukraine and getting out of the Minsk agreement. And they are also, for example, the Southern Command, they want to put their hands on the lithium in Chile, Argentina, and especially in Bolivia. And Bolivia does have an agreement with China to benefit the lithium and to start, for example, a nuclear energy system for medicine in Bolivia, like what happened in Iran. They will do whatever they can to sabotage the Brazilian diplomatic effort to do peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. And even the comedian, the Zelensky, wants to be in a peace talk with Brazilian diplomacy between them and Moscow. Washington is desperate to provoke as long as more conflicts as they can do this. For example, in the Pacific Ocean, the permanent example that they are provoking instability in Latin America, they are allowing the coup d'etat in Peru, for example. So I would say that unilateralism only promotes betraying elite ruling class against their own countries and promote even more war and more dissent in the international system.
John Bozich, on another note, Tehran says allegations concerning Iran's nuclear activities and its lack of transparency with the IAEA are a continuation of Washington's destructive policies, i.e. spreading Iranophobia. Is Washington, in your opinion, trying to spin this to justify the lethal and deadly sanctions that affect the people of Iran?
Well, I would go beyond saying that they're spinning this, because when you spin something, it's partially true, and you augment the true part, that minority aspect, and you diminish the majority aspect, which is false. They're not spinning the story against Iran, they're fabricating it. Iran is a signatory to the necessary agreements on nuclear power and nuclear generation. Iran complied with and placed cameras to watch its operations in nuclear clarification, nuclear, I've forgotten the term about the purification of the nuclear materials for power generation. Iran invited inspectors, and yet the United States continually maintained the lie that Iran was non-compliant. And they did all of this as if all of us were blind, because at the very same time, America's only real ally in the Middle East, Israel, is a non-signatory to these control agreements and is already a nuclear power, as the whistleblower Mordecai Vanunu revealed in Israel before they put him away for 18 years in solitary confinement for revealing Israel's illegal nuclear weapons program.
Bruno Beklini, talking about lack of transparency, it's the Israelis who are known as the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the West Asian region. They enjoy unconditional support from the U.S. They are not signatories to the NPT, as mentioned by Mr. Bozich right now. They do not cooperate with the IAEA. They're believed to have a clandestine atomic weapons program. How dangerous can this lack of transparency be, which is never mentioned by the U.S. and its allies?
We must remember what happened during the 1973 war against the Zionist entity. the former passed by minister Golda Meir, she threatened to throw an atomic bomb against the Cairo. The biggest threat against humanity nowadays is the reactor that they do have in Dimona, in the Negev Desert. Colin Powell, also former commander-in-chief of the U.S. forces and passed by also, he written that the Israeli do have at minimum 200 missiles and ogives, and they maybe do have 300 bombs. So the Zionist entity is the biggest threat to the whole humanity, talking about nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. And I would like to think so that, can we imagine Cuba reinstalling nuclear missiles in the island? What Washington would do nowadays? But they are threatening to install nuclear missiles around the Ukrainian frontier, for example, or even more inside from Ukraine. They would like to do this. So I would say that Israeli atomic bombs and atomic program is the open secret of the whole world. And the hypocrisy of the Western societies and the Western media, they are denying the facts and also putting the finger against Iran and other middle powers that only want to be sovereign and self-determined countries and societies.
Sure. John Bozich, on the Israeli nuclear weapons, the Iranian Foreign Ministry has said this is an outstanding example of hypocrisy, dual standards, and discriminatory policies of various U.S. administrations. How has this hypocrisy been ignored and overlooked?
Well, first of all, you're right. It's hypocrisy, and that's hypocrisy with a capital H, as in hydrogen bomb, not just nuclear weapons. The Israeli military program for nuclear weapons includes hydrogen bombs. That means the maximum nuclear capacity that exists. And this is not a rumor. It's not an allegation. It is a proven fact, because scientist Mordecai Vanunu, an Israeli nuclear scientist, revealed this and broke this story in Europe on the run, and he was kidnapped by Israeli military intelligence and taken back to Israel, where he was tried and convicted to 18 years to life in prison. And he was not allowed to speak to anybody for literally two decades. So that is not what you do with somebody who tells a rumor. Israel is a leading international nuclear power. That's the fact of the matter. The situation now is that America cannot continue to lie about this, and it cannot continue to have a double standard toward Iran unless it wants to cut